Here he comes, President Bush. It'll be only a cameo appearance from the president on this program today, but we have many other guests. He's walking, you can't see him. Actually, he's walking to the podium in the direct center of the frame, very presidential. But because the podium is on a stage, it blocks him. And so you can only sort of make out that it is the president, walking quite a long distance. The podium itself eclipses him. He gets there. The president has already landed a fighter plane on this aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln. He's changed out of his helmet, goggles, straps, and codpiece, full flight suit, into a crisp speech suit. He's smiling, he's nodding, he's looking around. And now we zoom out to reveal that red, white, and blue banner. Mission accomplished. Bush's landing on the aircraft carrier aped his many fictional predecessors who were also fighter pilots, like Harrison Ford in Air Force One or Bill Pullman in Independence Day. It reinforced the literary idea of one great leader being single-handedly responsible for military victory, like a mythological, medieval, or cinematic champion.
Officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Now, of course, major combat operations were not over in Iraq in 2003. So it was a failure as a speech, as a public relations move, as a photo opportunity, as an invasion. But as intertextual postmodern theater, it was definitely a success. Bush and his supervising producers expertly combined fiction and fact to make their candidate into a convincing cinematic hero. The staged mission accomplished landing used the familiarity of fiction like Air Force One, Top Gun, or Independence Day to influence its audience, just like when Bush aped John Wayne westerns and grunted that he wanted Bin Laden dead or alive. Many government productions are produced in a calculated way to benefit from public familiarity with fictional tropes. But who would believe a fictional background source for the search and capture mission of Saddam Hussein was a well-known 1980s movie starring Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey? Like Bush's handlers, I can also intertextually use popular films to advance my political and theatrical agenda. So to explore another ridiculous 2003 confluence of fiction and fact under the Bush administration, we are going to go all the way back to the first Bush presidency and to the infamous year which holds a special place in our national fictional consciousness, 1984.
Oh, it's so hard to remember.
Welcome to Never Forget Radio, where, from the comfort of your own home or your device, and from the safety of the future, we can revisit the memory of 9/11, of George W. Bush, and of all the years associated with both since. It's been over a decade of disappointment, failure, and disaster. I'm no expert, but I'll be your host as we explore our recent past and try to reclaim it. Let's roll. 1984. Now, you might be thinking that Bush 1 was elected president in 1988 and Bush 2 in 2000, so 1984 couldn't have been during the first Bush presidency. I say to you, A, Bush was not elected in 2000, and B, the Bush who was elected in 1988 wasn't quite Bush the first. W is actually far to the right of his father, H.W., who was more of a bureaucrat, a technocrat, a patrician steward, who just sort of continued his party's primacy, but without moving it farther to the right. He was not a populist like his son, but a confirmed Washington insider. The only president to have been either ambassador of the United Nations or director of the CIA. In fact, before he was with him, H.W. Bush was originally against Reagan and his economic plan, which he called voodoo economics. Voodoo economics.
So what I'm saying is that it's just not going to work. And it's very interesting that the man who invested this type of what I call a voodoo economic policy.
The real first Bush presidency was the presidency of Ronald Reagan. The actor was elected in 1980 with the same economic policies, tax cuts, reduction in government programs, huge deficit military spending, and a smaller version of the foreign policies of W. Huge increases in military spending, invasions of small countries, and the righteous religious rhetoric that divided the world into two camps, good and evil. America was at war with a faceless, implacable, totally opposite enemy who might attack at any time. Before Bush fought the Axis of Evil, Reagan battled the evil empire. Allen Ginsberg.
America, you don't really want to go to war. America's them bad Russians. Them Russians, and them Chinamen, and them Russians. The Russia wants to eat us alive. The Russia's power mad. She wants to take our cars from out our garages. Her wants to grab Chicago. Her wants our auto plants in Siberia. Him big bureaucracy running our filling stations. That no good. Ah, her make us all work 16 hours a day. Help. America, this is quite serious. America, this is the impression I get from looking in the television set. America, is this correct?
That's America from 1956. See you later, Allen Ginsberg. And in 1984, them Russians invaded in theaters across America. It was a red dawn.
What's going on here, my friend?
Yep, them Russians have invaded, and America's only hope is Patrick Swayze, Charlie Sheen, Jennifer Grey, and the inalienable right to bear arms.
We are under attack by conventional forces of the Russian army. It is believed the lead waves were disguised as commercial charter flights. Communications have broken down with other parts of the country. Large areas of the Midwest may have been overrun.
Red Dawn takes place in a 1984 that is slightly different from the real or fictional ones that we're used to, as we can see here in the introduction.
Soviet Union suffered worst wheat harvest in 55 years. Labor and food riots in Poland. Soviet troops invade. Cuba and Nicaragua reach troop strength goals of 500,000. El Salvador and Honduras fall. Green Party gains control of West German parliament. Demands withdrawal of nuclear weapons from European soil. Mexico plunged into revolution. NATO dissolves. United States stands alone.
United States stands alone. We open on a small town in the American rape culture hegemony. Let me try that again. We open on a small town in Colorado. Anyway, it's a normal day in this small town. Because for the right, small towns represent the real America, as Sarah Palin said on the campaign trail.
We believe that the best of America is in these small towns that we get to visit and in these wonderful little pockets of what I call real America, very patriotic, very pro-America areas of this great nation.
According to speechwriters and screenwriters, people in the cities who are more poor and black and brown and of all kinds, not to mention more educated and left, are not representative of the true America, whose ethos is expressed by small towns. Coincidentally, this is the America that 50s fearmongers created in response to the teeming ethnic diversity and labor leftism in the 30s and 40s, such that power brokers created a suburbanization in the 1950s through federal funding to highways and suburbs and away from cities and infrastructure.
What I call a voodoo economic policy.
Restrictive housing covenants and other tactics ensured the racist segregation of the new developments, thus co-creating this real America, this suburban America, which is a work of fiction, one that was underpinned by government subsidies and a massive boom in media and television, which codified the suburban heteronormative garage crew cut apron dog car.
America, this is the impression I get from looking in the television set. America, is this correct?
Archetypical American family, our concept of family, family values, the suburbs, the real America, is based on fiction on a massive scale. Anyway, one of these archetypical American suburbs wakes up one morning to discover that it is being invaded by the Soviets. Shocked and awed by this massive aerial invasion, Patrick Swayze and Charlie Sheen stockpile some arms, jump in their pickup truck, and head to the mountains with a trusted band of high schoolers, the Wolverines. They are lucky enough to find a shot-down Air Force Colonel, Powers Booth, to provide some exposition.
First wave of the attack came in disguised as commercial charter flights, same way they did in Afghanistan in 80.
This line encapsulates the immediate political purpose of the film. Writer and director John Milius turned the contemporary Russian invasion of Afghanistan on its head, presenting an invasion of our sacred shores. The Reagan administration used this invasion to amplify its Cold War rhetoric. Helping the Afghan resistance was our chance to covertly give the Russians an eastern military disaster to rival ours in Vietnam. Reagan held photo ops with freedom fighters in the White House, committed billions to research a missile defense system, Star Wars, and the CIA may or may not have funded the Taliban and Osama bin Laden, all in the fight against the Red Dawn. Although an 80s Russian invasion of the United States seems implausible, Milius actually consulted with administration figures, including Alexander Haig, Reagan's former Secretary of State. This is what they came up with.
They coordinated with selective nuke strikes, and the missiles were a hell of a lot more accurate than we thought. They took out the silos here in the Dakotas, key points of communication.
Like what?
Oh, like Omaha, Washington, Kansas City.
Gone?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
That's right.
Reagan and Milius's very 1984 version of the Cold War. The evil empire could attack at any time.
Russians reinforced with 60 divisions. Sent three whole army groups across the Bering Strait into Alaska. Cut the pipeline, came across Canada.
It seems that the weak policies of the opposition party have rotted America from within and invited invasion. Unfettered by nittering nabobs, the red realists have preemptively struck with nuclear weapons. Surprise! The subhuman simian Soviet soldiers are able to track down potential resistors using firearm registration information. That damn gun control lobby's gonna get us all killed come invasion. Liberal opposition has caused Reagan's military support for the far-right Nicaraguan Contra freedom fighters to fail. As hordes of Latin American communists, the Sandinistas, turn the world upside down and invade from Mexico. If only we'd built those border fences.
Filtrators came up illegal from Mexico. Cubans, mostly. They managed to infiltrate SAC bases in the Midwest, several down in Texas, and wreaked a hell of a lot of havoc, I'm here to tell you. They opened up the door down here, and the whole Cuban and Nicaraguan armies come walking right through.
Along with its warning against restrictions on gun ownership, Red Dawn also encompasses white Americans' fear of illegal aliens. In his 1998 book, The Ecology of Fear, the Marxist urban scholar Mike Davis tried to understand the unconscious fantasies behind the enduring popularity of over a century of disaster and invasion fiction.
The abiding hysteria of all disaster fiction, the urge to strike out and destroy, to wipe out an entire city and untold thousands of its inhabitants, is rooted in racial anxiety. From the earliest 19th century examples to the latest survivalist fantasies, white fear of the dark races lies at the heart of such visions. In the shadowlands of white anxiety, the distinction between the images of space alien and illegal alien was subjected to repeated elision. Immigration and invasion in a paranoid register became synonyms.
So not only is Red Dawn a hyper-masculine John Birch Society fantasy, it also fits in the umbrella of disaster and invasion fiction. The invaders are aliens or alien, and they represent the subconscious, often sexual fear of takeover by foreign races or groups of people who are considered subhuman in the American white subconscious. Davis finds evidence of this throughout the history of fiction from H.G. Wells through to Independence Day. This fictional legacy of invasion has driven both public fear and public policy, which are usually the same thing when you talk about immigration.
The post-1980 boom in imagined aliens coincided with the increasing visibility of immigrants from Mexico, Central America, and East Asia. Like the Aryan survivalist novel, the fantasy of alien impregnation played off white fear and disorientation in the face of irreversible demographic change.
This fear of sexual contamination by the other is one reason why there's so much terrorist activity in this country by white Americans against non-white Americans. It's also why when the Wolverines visit Ben Johnson outside of town to stock up on supplies, after providing them with ammunition, Campbell's soup, and cornflakes, he bestows on them something far more valuable to a terrified patriarchal society.
I got a couple of heirlooms I want to hide with you.
He's opening a trap door. Is there a spider hole down there?
My granddaughters. Sons of bitches tried having their way with them. Tony, Erica, this is Matt and Jed Eckert. They're going to take care of you.
Ben Johnson literally transfers ownership of his granddaughters Leah Thompson and Jennifer Grey to child soldiers Patrick Swayze and Charlie Sheen. Faced with a sexually threatening alien enemy, the patriarch understands that he is too old to perform his protectionist functions, so he gives his granddaughters, explicitly referring to them as property,
a couple of heirlooms,
to the young men with guns who will protect them. He says that the Russians tried to have their way with them, and in one line illustrates one of the primal reasons for war. In a patriarchal society where women are seen as subhuman property, men will war to acquire or protect them. After this ownership ceremony, the young men ride away from society towards the mountains, the women clinging to them on the backs of their thundering horses.
Wolverines!
Disaster and invasion fiction, the cities are cathartically destroyed. The simultaneously haughty, overeducated, and animalistically brown people in the cities die by the anonymous millions. Those unmourned Sodoms smolder as a band of white, or in these tokenist days, largely white people, goes into the woods or mountains where all of a sudden their inherently noble whiteness, strict adherence to the codes of masculinity, and their militaristic attitudes and skills are validated after a violent test. A new society is formed based on ancient patriarchal values.
When I grew up, I spent 2 years living in Colorado in the mountains. And all my friends in Colorado, we all thought we were mountain men.
Here's Red Dawn writer-director John Millions.
And we went hunting all the time. We had trap lines and stuff like this. And the whole thing of living up there, you know, thinking about when, you know, we'd always talk about, you know, when the Russians come. Because there was always, we were promised that the Russians would come. And therefore, all of society would break down. And we would have to fight the Russians with our caplock rifles. And live in the mountains, so this was sort of a fantasy for
John Milius, the real-life model for John Goodman's Walter Sobchak from The Big Lebowski, talking about the film. Invasion and disaster fiction like Red Dawn helps to keep the white men of the right in a permanent Cold War state of paranoid readiness, frightening, out-of-place attitudes in peacetime, like Walter taking out his piece at the bowling alley, become necessary in wartime, thus validating years of training, stoicism, and faithful vigilance. All of a sudden, the patriarchal attitudes and militaristic skills of real men become essential.
Yeah, I knew I was right. I knew it. I was tough on both of you. And I did things that made you hate me sometimes. But you understand now, don't you?
Can't afford to be crying anymore now. I won't either one of you ever cry for me again. Whatever, do it. Not as long as you live.
Harry Dean Stanton plays Patrick Swayze and Charlie Sheen's father, whose role is to transmit to his sons the deadly original sin-like code of retributionist barbaric militarism. Cyclical unresolved intergenerational violent trauma. I mean stoic hyper-masculine alienation. I mean American heroism.
Boys! Avenge me! Avenge me!
Decades later, a new generation would get their chance. As slaveholding rapist Thomas Jefferson once said,
"The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of fictional invaders."
If you're seeing this broadcast, you are in a part of the country no longer controlled by the government of the United States.
What are we supposed to do?
I'm going to fight. Anybody who wants to join is welcome to it. We'll hit them on our terms.
We're the Wolverines, and we create chaos.
Now, Red Dawn was remade in 2012, and this new film was explicitly designed to capitalize on a new American fear, which, like fear of illegal aliens or zombies or Muslims, is one of the many replacements for the original Cold War fear of the Reds. Americans whisper about them every day, that they're catching up, that our status as the world's only superpower is about to be usurped by the Chinese.
America's them bad Russians. Them Russians, and them Chinamen.
But in a stroke of Hollywood irony, the villains were changed at the last minute to the North Koreans. Hollywood makes so much money from selling its films in China that they had to change the Red Dawn remake in post-production. They didn't change the actors. All they did was digitally change the flags and some words of dialogue in the subtitles, and all of a sudden, the invading Chinese forces became the invading North Korean forces. Americans are so blinded by racial fears that they can't tell space aliens from illegal aliens. They certainly can't tell Asian people apart. In fact, although the Chinese and North Korean soldiers were played by American actors, the former Marine football-playing American hero was portrayed by Australian Chris Hemsworth, who also recently played a Norwegian god in Thor. I guess American audiences can't really tell white people apart either. They just see white good. They just must think white is good, and everyone else is a bad guy. But whether the invaders are Soviet, Cuban, Nicaraguan, alien, Chinese, or North Korean, the basic story is the same ridiculous scenario where the Americans, the world's most powerful and imperialistic country, a nation which has occupying armies on every continent, somehow becomes the sympathetic underdog.
Wolverines!
The last time the U.S. was the underdog was probably the War of 1812. In all other conflicts outside of the World Cup and quality of life, healthcare, and imprisonment ratings, the U.S. has been the overdog, but that doesn't sell or inspire. We have got to pretend to be a scrappy band of free individuals resisting a more powerful evil foe. Because the problem with fighting terrorism or fighting a war of occupation in, say, Vietnam or Afghanistan or Iraq, or in any of the myriad places where the Reagan, and let's not forget the Clinton and Obama administrations sent troops, the problem with fighting a war of occupation is that you can't sell it. People don't identify with the role of the occupier. They only identify to their credit with the role of the oppressed. People identify with the underdog. In fact, a great intertextual triumph of Red Dawn is that the film's occupying Soviets commandeer the local theater to show Alexander Nevsky, Sergei Eisenstein's 1938 film about Russian resistance to German invasion. Even this movie's overdog occupying army can only relate to fictional underdogs. Nobody identifies with occupying armies, even occupying armies. Now, if this wasn't silly enough, the United States' effort to capture Saddam Hussein in occupied Iraq in 2003 was named after the film, Operation Red Dawn. Guerrilla warfare, insurgency resistance, helicopters chasing men on horses, small bands of former citizens terrorizing and occupying foreign army. You can see how Iraq and Red Dawn are similar. But the United States was not the underdog in Operation Red Dawn. They were literally an occupying army pursuing a fugitive who was holed up in a hole. But nevertheless, the soldiers of Operation Red Dawn identified with the high school guerrillas, Swayze, Sheen, and the Wolverines. USA Today interviewed Captain Jeffrey McMurray, who picked the name in December 2003.
Operation Red Dawn was so fitting because it was a patriotic, pro-American movie.
John Milius added,
I was deeply flattered and honored. It's nice to have a lasting legacy. The spirit of the Wolverines. The message of Red Dawn is to liberate the oppressed.
I hope these soldiers learned something from Red Dawn to prepare them for the next decade of fighting an Iraqi insurgency. After they nuked the cities and invaded small towns with ground troops, an overconfident Soviet leader might have made a speech like,
Major combat operations in the United States have ended. In the Battle of the United States, Russian troops and our allies have prevailed.
Red Dawn's epilogue makes clear that the occupying Russian forces eventually had to leave the country. Operation Red Dawn was a total inversion of the film Red Dawn, which is literally about an occupying power hunting down the leaders of the resistance piece by piece. But American soldiers and ordinary American people were able to see themselves as Wolverines because of the irresistible myth of the underdog. Because dualistic fictional tropes make multifaceted geopolitics understandable. And because the permanent American script declares that we are the good guys, and our opponents, whether space alien, illegal alien, Soviet, pan-Asian, undead, or Iraqi, are the bad guys. The Axis of Evil, the evil empire, the alien overdog.
Never Forget Radio is a production of Bookstyle Publications, currently located in West Philadelphia. Music for this episode was created by Old Table, Jay-Z, Basil Polidorus, the Red Dawn soundtrack composer, and Sergei Prokofiev. We don't really recommend the Red Dawn movies, but we would like to second the recommendation of the invading Soviet army and mention that Alexander Nevsky, with score by Prokofiev, can be seen on YouTube. If you like this program and want to know more, or suggest a future topic, or offer a piece of your mind, particularly criticism from the left, you can find us at Never Forget Radio on Facebook, Gmail, or Tumblr, or Never Forget Pod on Twitter. all of our episodes can be downloaded for free. Please visit our Tumblr page for further explanation on Allen Ginsberg and his poem, America. If you'd like to support this program, please feel free to donate any amount. The Red Dawn remake grossed over $48 million. In today's quote, Patrick Swayze is about to execute a captured Russian prisoner.
You want blindfolds? It's part of the Geneva Convention. I never heard of it.
What kind of voice do I do here?
You want blindfolds?
This violates the Geneva Convention.
I never heard of it.
Thank you. And never forget.
Never. Never. Never forget.
That's it. That's all I got.